Is depression a chemical imbalance? What do we know about depression, its causes, and its treatment? Yuan Hari suffered from depression since he was a child and started taking antidepressants when he was a teenager. He was told that his problems were caused by a chemical imbalance in his brain. As an adult, trained in the social sciences, he began to investigate whether this was true. And he learned that almost everything we've been told about depression and anxiety is wrong.
Everywhere I went, from Berlin to Buenos Aires, from Sydney to Sao Paulo to San Francisco, I could see the most successful approaches to reducing depression and anxiety were ones that dealt with the reasons why people are so depressed in the first place.
Yuan Hari is the author of Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. It's time for Progressive Spirit. Be right back. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen, and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network, PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net, I'm John Shuck. Yuan Hari suffered from depression since he was a child, and he took antidepressants as a teenager because he was told that depression is the result of a chemical imbalance in the brain. And he went on a quest to see if this is really the case. In his book, Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions, he discusses that journey. He interviewed many social scientists who are uncovering evidence that depression and anxiety are largely caused by key problems with the way we live today, not brain chemistry.
You know, I'll give you an example. There's a study that asked Americans, how many close friends do you have who you can call on in a crisis? And when they started doing it years ago, the most common answer was 5. Today, the most common answer is none, right? A society of profoundly lonely, isolated people, told that life is about money and status, you know, who think that life is about screaming at each other through screens, is going to be a society with a depression and anxiety crisis for a really good reason. And it's not just because something went wrong inside their skulls, right? And if we tell people a story that it's just biological, what that does is it cuts us off from understanding the real causes of these problems in our own individual lives and in the wider society. And that is a disaster.
Yuan Hari is a New York Times best-selling author. His book, Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, has been translated into 15 languages and is currently being adapted into a major Hollywood film and into a nonfiction documentary series. He's one of the most viewed TED talkers of all time. His talk, Everything You Think You Know About Addiction Is Wrong. He has written over the past 7 years for some of the world's leading newspapers and magazines, including the New York Times, the LA Times, The Guardian, The Spectator, The Millbourne Age, and Politico. He's also appeared on leading television shows, including HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher. He was twice named National Newspaper Journalist of the Year by Amnesty International. And he's also been named Cultural Commentator of the Year and Environmental Commentator of the Year at the Comment Awards. He's with me via Skype from London. Welcome, Johan, to Progressive Spirit.
Hey, John. It's really good to be with you.
Really glad having you here. I very much appreciated your book, and we're going to talk about it now. Tell me, just give an overview here. Why this book and why now?
There were these two mysteries that were really haunting me. The first was, I'm 39 years old. Every year that I've been alive, depression and anxiety have increased in the United States and in Britain. And I wanted to understand why. And the reason I wanted to understand why was because of the second mystery to me, which is very personal. When I was a teenager, I had gone to my doctor and I'd explained that I had this feeling like pain was kind of leaking out of me and I couldn't control it or regulate it. I felt very ashamed about it. And my doctor told me a story about why I felt this way that was totally biological. He said, we know why people feel like this. There's this chemical called serotonin in people's brains. Some people, it makes them feel good. Some people are naturally lacking it. You're clearly one of them. We'll give you these drugs and you'll feel better. And I started taking chemical antidepressants. I felt an immediate and really huge boost. For a couple of months, I felt great. And then this feeling of pain started to bleed back through. I went back to my doctor. He gave me a higher dose. Again, I felt better. Again, the feeling of pain started to bleed back through. And this kind of continued until for 13 years, I was taking the maximum possible dose, at the end of which I still felt terrible. And I thought, well, there must be something going on here, right? What's happening? It seemed to me, although I was afraid to acknowledge it to myself, it couldn't just be that it's a chemical imbalance, because why would it be rising so much if that was the only problem here? So I ended up going on a big, long journey. I went over 40,000 miles and interviewed the leading experts in the world about what causes depression and anxiety and what solves them. And I went to places that just have very different perspectives on this, from an Amish village in Indiana, because the Amish have very low levels of depression, to a city in Brazil that banned advertising to see if that would make people feel better, to a lab at one of the most prestigious universities in the United States where they're giving people psychedelic drugs to trigger spiritual experiences to see if that would make them feel better. And I learned so many things. But one is, I realized when I was a teenager, until I went to my doctor, I thought that my depression was all in my head, meaning, you know, I was just weak. I needed to man up, you know, all the kind of cliches. And then for the next 13 years, I thought it was all in my head, meaning, you know, it was a chemical imbalance in my brain, right? Actually, the main thing I learned is there are real biological causes that make depression worse, like your genes. I write about them very clearly in Lost Connections. But overwhelmingly, the causes of depression and anxiety are not in our heads. They're in the way we live. That in the book, I write about 9 key causes of depression and anxiety for which there's scientific evidence. 2 of them are biological, but 7 are factors in the way we live. And once you understand that, it opens up a very different way of thinking about the solutions.
So let's go talk about, first of all, these SSRIs, because that's been the solution du jour, right? They are the fancy name, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And we pass those out in the United States, in the UK, and perhaps elsewhere, like candy. 20 million Americans are on these. They're anything from, what, Paxil to Zoloft to Prozac. Those things that this idea that it's a chemical thing, and that is a good story when the story that we have heard that you mentioned earlier, that it's because I'm depressed because I'm just, you know, not capable. I need to get up out, you know, pull myself up and do all that kind of stuff that doesn't work. So a chemical answer to my story is helpful, right? But on the other end, it isn't true either in many respects. Would you say that these SSRIs are a little more than what, placebos?
We need to have a nuanced conversation about chemical antidepressants, because I think too often the conversation gets hijacked into are you for or against them, which I think is too simplistic a way of thinking about what's happening here. One of the ways we know the effectiveness of chemical antidepressants, this can be measured. Depression is measured by something called the Hamilton scale. So I always felt sorry for whoever Hamilton was, that we only remember him by how miserable we all are. But the Hamilton scale goes from 1, where you would be dancing around in joy, to 51, where you would be acutely suicidal. And to give people a sense of what movement on the Hamilton scale looks like, if you improve your sleep patterns, you will get a boost of 6 points on the Hamilton scale. And if your sleep patterns radically deteriorate, like when you have a baby, you'll go 6 points the other way. According to the leading expert at Harvard Medical School, on average, chemical antidepressants move you 1.8 points on the Hamilton scale. So it's important to say a few things. Firstly, that's an average. So initially, I got more than that. Over time, I got a lot less than that. Also important to say 1.8 points is not nothing, right? You can understand why if you were, you know, acutely suicidal, for example, 1.8 points might be the thing that saves your life by taking you off the bridge. That is relief worth having. Now, alongside that benefit, people get, in many cases, not all, very powerful side effects. I put on a huge amount of weight, like 75% of men who take these drugs, that affected my sexual functioning. So I had very powerful side effects. Some people do not have such powerful side effects. So you can see there, that's a nuanced picture about chemical castration. It's not just thumbs up, thumbs down. There's real benefit. It's quite small for most people. It's alongside a lot of side effects. So you can see how that's not an argument against chemical antidepressants. It's an argument for a more realistic conversation about them. But the thing that most struck me about this is I went and interviewed this South African psychiatrist called Derek Summerfield. He's a great guy. And Derek happened to be in Cambodia when chemical antidepressants were first introduced in that country. It was 2001. He wasn't there to study this. It was just by coincidence he was there at that time. And the Cambodian doctors didn't know what these drugs were. So they were like, what are they? And Derek explained. And they said to him, oh, we don't need antidepressants. We've already got antidepressants. And he said, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about some kind of chemical, you know, kind of a herbal remedy or something, right? Instead, they told him a story. There was a farmer in their community who one day had stood on a landmine left over by the war with the United States and had his leg blown off. And they had given him an artificial leg and he went back to work in the rice fields. But apparently it's super painful to work underwater when you've got an artificial leg. And I'm imagining it was really traumatic because he's been blown up in this field. The guy started to cry all day, didn't want to get out of bed, classic depression. They said to Derek, we gave him an antidepressant. Derek said, what was it? They explained that they went and sat with him. They listened to him. They realized that his pain made sense. They figured if they bought him a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. He wouldn't be in this situation that was making him so depressed. They bought him a cow. Within a couple of weeks, his depression went away. He was fine. They said to Derek, so that cow, that was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right? Now, if you've been raised to think about depression the way we have, that it's just a chemical imbalance in your brain, that sounds like a bad joke, right? I went to my doctor for an antidepressant. He gave me a cow. But what those Cambodian doctors knew intuitively is what the World Health Organization, the leading medical body in the world, has been trying to tell us for years. If you're depressed, if you're anxious, you're not a machine with broken parts. You're a human being with unmet needs, and you need support and help to get those needs met. Everyone listening to this show knows that you have natural physical needs, right? You need to have food, you need to have water, you need to have clean air, you need to have shelter. If I took those things away from you, you would be in real trouble real fast. There's equally strong evidence that human beings have natural psychological needs. You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that people see you and value you. You need to feel you've got a future that makes sense. Now, our culture is good at lots of things. I'm glad to be alive today. But we are getting less and less good at meeting these deep underlying psychological needs that human beings have, which is one of the key reasons why we have this depression and anxiety crisis. And I wanted to figure out, and a big part of my book, Lost Connections, is about, well, what's the cow for our problem, right? We need to expand our idea of what an antidepressant is. An antidepressant should be regarded as anything that reduces people's depression. Now, of course, chemical antidepressants should be one of the things on the menu, but we need a radically expanded menu of options. Thinking about that, and I write about seven of them in the book.
Yeah, one of them, if you don't mind, is to talk about meaningful work. People go to work, and you use the example, one point, the person shakes paint cans, and that's it, day after day after day. But you also talked about a work structure in which it's more democratic, and that gives people a sense of ownership and control over the work, and that really creates a huge difference in terms of depression, if that's perhaps one of the causes. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I noticed that lots of the people that I know who are depressed and anxious, their depression and anxiety focuses around their work. So I started to look initially at what's the evidence about how people feel about their work. Figures are quite shocking on this. Gallup, the opinion poll company, what they found was 13% of us, 13%, like our work most of the time. 63% are what they called sleepwalking through their work. So they don't like it, they don't hate it, they just kind of tolerate it. And 24% of people hate and fear their jobs. So that's quite striking. Yeah. 87% of people don't like the thing they're doing most of their waking life, right? I start to think, well, could that have some relationship with our mental and emotional health? So I began to look for evidence about this, and I learned that there's an extraordinary Australian social scientist called Professor Michael Marmot, who I got to know, who had discovered the core of what causes depression at work. It's not the only thing, but it's the biggest cause. If you go to work and you feel you are controlled, so you have low or no autonomy over your work, you are much more likely to become depressed. You're actually much more likely to drop dead of a heart attack. And at first, I actually misunderstood what Professor Marmot was saying, right? I thought he was saying, okay, so you've got these 13% of people who get to have jobs where they're, you know, which they enjoy, and they're the kind of elite, and they're going to have nice lives, and the other 87% are just condemned to be kind of miserable, right? And I thought about my dad, who was a bus driver, my mother, who worked in a shelter, my grandmother, whose job was to clean toilets, my brother, who's a delivery guy. And I thought, wait, are we just saying that they're condemned to be depressed? And Professor Marmot said to me, you know, yeah, and you don't understand. It's not the work that makes you depressed. It's being controlled at work. And I discovered there's actually a cow for that, if you like. There's a solution to that. So I went to Baltimore and interviewed an incredible person called Meredith Keough. So Meredith used to go to bed every Sunday night just sick with anxiety, right? She did an office job. It wasn't the worst. She told me it wasn't the worst office job in the world. She wasn't being bullied or harassed or anything. But she just, it was really monotonous, and she couldn't bear the thought, she was quite young, that this was going to be the next 40 years of her life. So with her husband, Josh, she did this quite bold thing. Josh had worked in bike stores in Baltimore since he was a kid. And one day in this, you know, which is insecure, controlled work, as you can imagine, one day with his colleagues, Josh just said to himself, what does our boss actually do? They liked their boss. It wasn't a particularly bad guy. But they were like, we seem to fix all the bikes and he seems to make all the money. So they decided they were going to set up a bike store that worked on a different principle. Their bike store, very successful business now, it's called Baltimore Bicycle Works, is not a corporation with a boss at the top who tells everyone what to do. It's a democratic cooperative. That means they take all the big decisions about the company together by voting. They share out the good tasks and the kind of cruddy tasks, so no one gets stuck with the depressing jobs. And they share the profits, obviously. And one of the things that was so interesting to me spending time at Baltimore Bicycle Works was how many of them, completely in line with Professor Marmot's research, said they used to be depressed and anxious in this previous way of working and were not in this different way of working because they dealt with the factor that causes depression at work, which is control, right? They had it's important to say, it's not like they quit their jobs fixing bikes and now they're, you know, Beyonce's backing singers, right? They fixed bikes before they fixed bikes
They're
now.
Doing the same job physically, right?
Exactly. The difference is now they've got control over their environment. Think about how many people, and this is not saying everyone listening to this should do that because, you know, most people will not be able to do what they did. This is an argument for a structural change in our society. Think about how many people you know who are depressed and anxious now, John, who would feel very differently if they knew that tomorrow they were going into a workplace where they made the decisions alongside their colleagues about what they should be doing. Where if there has to be a boss, he's elected by them and accountable to them, where they control their workplace together with the people around them. And of course, in line with market competition, because the Baltimore Bicycle Works still competes with other companies, obviously. That would be a very different way of living, right? That's a very different way of spending most of your waking life. It's one where you can invest your work with meaning. It comes back to what we were saying before. Human beings need to feel our lives are meaningful. And if you're controlled all the time, you it's very hard to construct meaning out of controlled work. But if you have a say over it, then you can construct a lot more meaning. You can begin to think, how could we do this better? How can we improve this? How could we do more interesting stuff? You know, you can see that opens up a very different way of living. And this is the thing we do most of our waking lives. The average person answers their first work email at 7:48 a.m. and clocks off work at 7:15 p.m., right? If we don't deal with that, it's very hard to see how we're going to deal with this wider crisis.
Well, yes. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Johann Hari. His book is called Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. Now, in all of the problems that you lay out in your book and the solutions for those, they are not individual. I mean, the response, a healthy response to depression involves a community. It involves really a whole change, in a sense, of our structure, which is how we relate to each other, how we relate to the messages that have been given to us by a capitalistic society, the lies, frankly, often that we're told in order to for our militaries to keep the stuff and to keep bombing other countries. Whatever it might be that puts us down, it is more than just an individual. And yet the treatment that we have, because we're so isolated, is to go to the individual doctor and get an individual pill. How do we begin to break that down? I mean, how do we, and so Big Pharma, as you write about quite a bit in your book, is responsible for the individual pill because that's a good moneymaker. And that's part of the whole sickness too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's worth reiterating, that doesn't mean that those pills have no value. They have some value for some people, but they're not solving the problem for most of us. And I think there's a really interesting, as you were saying that, John, I was thinking about a really interesting piece of research that really blew my mind. In some ways, it's quite simple, but it was quite shocking to me. I went interviewed, it was done by a wonderful woman called Dr. Brett Ford and her colleagues. I went to go and see her in Berkeley. So it looked at a really simple question. If you, John, decided you were going to spend more time, more hours a day, deliberately trying to make yourself happier, would you actually become happier? And they did this research in four countries. They did it in the United States, China, Russia, and Japan. And what they found was initially really strange. What they found is in the United States, if you try consciously to make yourself happier, you will not become happier. But in the other countries, if you consciously tried to make yourself happier, you did in fact become happier. And they were like, what's going on? So they looked more closely, and what they discovered is in the United States, generally, if you try to make yourself happier, what you do is you do something for yourself, right? You buy something for yourself, you show off on Instagram, you try to get a promotion, you do something for you. In the other places, generally, of course, not in every case, when you tried to make yourself happier, you generally did something for someone else. You tried to help your family, your community. These were just implicit scripts in people's minds, right? We think happiness is an individual thing. Most of the world thinks happiness is a collective thing. And it turns out our vision of happiness just doesn't work very well, right? Their vision of happiness does. So I was interested in looking at places that have tried to pioneer approaches, responses to depression, for example, that deal with that. And there was one of the heroes of my book, Lost Connections, is someone who discovered a really interesting way of responding to this. So the doctor, as you can tell from my weird Downton Abbey accent, I'm from Britain, although I spend a lot of time in the US. A wonderful doctor in East London called Sam Everington. He was a general practitioner, and he had loads of people coming to him with depression and anxiety. And like me, he's not opposed to chemical antidepressants, but he just thought, this isn't enough, right? He could see these were really lonely people. They were really cut off from the natural world. They're cut from all sorts of things human beings need. He decided to pioneer a different approach. A woman came to him called Lisa Cunningham, who I got to know quite well. Lisa had been shut away in her home for 7 years with crippling depression and anxiety. And one day, Sam said to her, don't worry, I'll carry on giving you the drugs, but I'm also going to prescribe something else. I'm going to prescribe for you to take part in a group. And there was an area behind the doctor's surgery. I don't think I can say, involved swearing, what people used to call it. It was called Dog Mess Alley, right? It was just a kind of area of scrubland that dogs would use. And he said to Lisa, what I'd like you to do is turn up twice a week. I'll turn out and support you. And with a group of other depressed and anxious people, let's turn this alley into something beautiful. Let's turn it into a garden. The first meeting they had, Lisa was literally physically sick with anxiety. But what happened is a couple of things. Firstly, the people in the group had something to talk about that wasn't how terrible they felt. They could talk about gardening. They started to put their fingers in the soil. They started to learn how you plant things. They were inner city people. They didn't know any of this stuff. There's lots of evidence that interacting with the natural world is an extremely powerful antidepressant. And they got to know each other, and they did what human beings do when we get together in groups. They started to help each other. They started to solve each other's problems. For example, one of the guys in the group was sleeping on a public bus, right, at night because he had nowhere to go. Everyone else in the group was outraged. They started pressuring the local authority to get this guy housed. They succeeded. It was the first time they'd done anything for someone else in years. It made them feel great. People started complimenting them on how beautiful this garden was. The way Lisa put it to me was, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. There was a study in Norway that found a very similar program was more than twice as successful as chemical antidepressants in reducing depression and anxiety. I think for a kind of obvious reason. It was dealing with the reasons why people felt so terrible in the first place. And everywhere I went, from Berlin to Buenos Aires, from Sydney to Sao Paulo to San Francisco, I could see the most successful approaches to reducing depression and anxiety were ones that dealt with the reasons why people are so depressed in the first place. And it's not irrational, right? It's not some, of course, there are biological factors that can make it worse, which are very real and are playing out in a significant number of people. But largely, this is a crisis being driven by the fact that we live in a culture that doesn't meet our deeper psychological needs, right? For most of us, I would say a big majority of us, at least, being depleted by this lack of our needs being met. And to do that, and one of the things that was so interesting is looking at all the different places that pursued solutions, was realizing these insights are so close to the surface, right? It's not like explaining quantum physics to someone, not that I could do that anyway, but it's not like explaining quantum physics. It's not like explaining some hugely complex science, right? In a way, I feel like what I'm saying is almost stupidly obvious, right?
That's what I'm getting at too. I'm thinking this is stuff my mother taught me. I mean, you know, but she passed at 91, but I mean, she grew up in an age in which you'd dealt with things. If you want to be happy, go and do something for somebody else. I mean, she would say that. So there's a question I want to talk. What is the link? What's the between psychological and social and biological in regards to depression? What's the relationship between those things?
All three play out in all forms of mental distress, right, to some degree. Even think of it something as extreme as dementia, right? Dementia is obviously heavily driven by the biology. It's a physical deterioration or disruption in the brain. But even with dementia, we know that people who have strong social connections are significant. They develop the symptoms much less quickly. We know there's a psychological aspect because we know people who are optimistic, people who have very good psychological skills, again, develop the symptoms less likely. Now, with something like depression, there is a significant biological component, of course, that plays out. But the social and psychological factors massively interact with it. So all three of them interact. It's not like they're separate things in separate little kind of containers. All three of them interact in complex ways. But we know that dealing with these deeper social and psychological causes. So, I mean, we've only touched on a few of the ones that I write about in Lost Connections. So I'll give you very briefly, because I know we're running out of time. But for example, a psychological cause, childhood trauma makes you radically more likely to become depressed or attempt suicide as an adult. I found this very painful to learn the science about because I had experienced some quite extreme violence from an adult when I was a child. But what's very optimistic about this is actually what there's this incredible science that I learned about from a wonderful man called Dr. Vincent Felitti in San Diego, who's shown if you give people spaces in which they can talk about their childhood trauma, in which they will see they will not be judged for it. In fact, people will say this should never have happened to you. We're sorry this happened to you. That in itself and on its own leads to a really significant fall in depression and anxiety. So there's this big range of causes. We need to have a much more complex conversation about depression. Up to now, we've had this ridiculously simplistic story where you're just told, oh, it's just lack of a chemical in your brain, and maybe there's a little bit of therapy that will help you as well. When actually, and I'm not particularly critical of doctors, you know, we've only given doctors one lever to pull, right? Or maybe two, some of them can refer you to a therapist. So in a sense, most doctors haven't got the option to do what, for example, that gardening program or many of the other options that I talk about in the book, some of which are big social changes, right? A doctor can't say to you, I prescribe a democratic workplace to you, right? That's something that has to be done at a much bigger social level, right? And a social transformation. But I do think that the evidence is clear that if we continue to be a society where, you know, I'll give you an example. There's a study that asked Americans, how many close friends do you have who you can call on in a crisis? And when they started doing it years ago, the most common answer was 5. Today, the most common answer is none, right? A society of profoundly lonely, isolated people told that life is about money and status, you know, who think that life is about screaming at each other through screens, is going to be a society with a depression and anxiety crisis for a really good reason. And it's not because something went wrong inside their skulls, right? And if we tell people a story that it's just biological, what that does is it cuts us off from understanding the real causes of these problems in our own individual lives and in the wider society, and that is a disaster.
My guest is Johann Hari, author of Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. More to come. Stay with us. I'm John Schuck. This is Progressive Spirit. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm and click donate. Johann Hari is my guest. He's the author of Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. This is Progressive Spirit. I'm John Schuck. You know, I think you wrote in your book that you describe yourself as an atheist, but right there you sound like a preacher who has something good to say. I mean, about building community and finding values, you know?
It's so interesting you say that, because there's something I found quite challenging. So I looked at this research about, so a lot of people will know, until the mid-1960s, there was a lot of research done giving LSD to people with things like depression and alcoholism.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about, that's a question I wanted to ask you about. What role is psychedelics in this?
Well, the research in the 60s was, you know, it wasn't done to the standards that we would want science to be done today, but it was, you know, they were pretty suggestive results. And then the Nixon administration just shuts it all down, right?
Yeah.
And in the last kind of 8 years, this research has been very slowly reopened. So I went and interviewed the teams of scientists who've been doing this in Los Angeles, in Baltimore, in New York, in Oslo, in Norway, in Sao Paulo, in Brazil, and in London. And it's totally fascinating, and there's loads of things I could say about it. But I'll just tell you one that I think really relates to your area of concern, John. So there's a study that was done in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University, where they take chronic long-term smokers who've tried to stop smoking loads of ways. I feel personal about this because my mother is a chronic smoker. There's a picture of my mother and me when I'm 6 months old. She's breastfeeding me, smoking, and resting the ashtray on my stomach. When I showed her this photo, she said, "You were a difficult baby. I needed that cigarette." So they take people like my mother and they give them 3 doses of psilocybin, which is the active component in magic mushrooms. Uh-huh. And what they found was absolutely extraordinary. 80% of them stopped smoking, 80%, right? And had still were still no longer smokers more than a year afterwards, right? To give you a sense of comparison, the next most successful smoking treatment is nicotine patches, and that has a 17% success rate. It's extraordinary, right? And they're trying to figure out what's going on here. Many interesting things are happening there, but one is there's a subset of those findings that to me I think was really fascinating. So when you give people psilocybin, most people will have what in the broadest terms would be considered a spiritual experience. You have a sense that you are deeply connected to the world, to people around you, to the natural world. You have a sense of your ego shrinking and your sense that the world is, you know, an amazing place, right? You can measure that. Some mm-hmm. people have a very intense spiritual experience and some people have no spiritual experience at all. And what they found is the positive effects like reduction in depression, addiction, and so on were extremely closely correlated with how intense your spiritual experience was. So if you had a super intense spiritual experience, you had lots of positive effects. If you had no spiritual experience, you had no positive effects. And I think that tells you something about the value of spirituality defined in the broadest possible sense. So I'm an atheist. I don't think that means I don't have spiritual values. You know, I have, for me, they're moments of profound human connection. They come in, you know, actually things like political protests. So I feel an incredible sense of spirituality, you know, moments when people come together to demand something better, for example, is one thing that comes to mind, but there are obviously many. One of the things that we get from spirituality is a release from the sense of the ego, right? It's interesting speaking to the team in London who've been doing this research. What they show is one of the things that happens when you take psilocybin is your capacity to think egotistically just massively reduces, right? You can't think about yourself. You could only think about things around you. Now, obviously, you also see why we need an ego, because you wouldn't want to walk around the whole time in that state. But you could also see what your ego blocks out. And so the need for spirituality and spiritual experiences is very deep in human beings, right? It gives people many things. It gives them a sense of meaning. It gives them a sense of a much bigger story than themselves. And you know better than I do what these things we get. These are essential human needs. They are not like trivial add-ons. And one of the reasons why we have a depression and anxiety crisis. So I talk about in the book, you know, everyone knows junk food has taken over our diets and made us physically sick, right? I don't say so any judgment. I basically lived on KFC for 10 years. Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me is a similar thing has happened with our values. A kind of junk values have taken over our minds and made us mentally sick. There's a wonderful man you should interview for your show. Actually, you'd really like him. He's called Professor Tim Kasser. And okay. He did this incredible research showing that for 25 years, he's been producing this research. He's shown the more you think life is about money and status, the more likely you are to become depressed and anxious for a whole range of reasons that he's proven. You know, I think that tells you something, right? Our whole culture is geared towards getting us to think in these materialistic ways. President Trump is not an aberration from that culture. He's the culmination of that culture, right?
Oh yeah, and he's the embodiment. He's come back to roost. He's us come back to roost, I think.
I don't say this to be critical of Trump supporters, who I think are suffering a lot and need a lot of love and support. And I really don't like sneering at Trump voters. I think it's really actually making the problem worse.
Yes.
Because of Trump himself, I didn't want to say that as if I know you're not saying that either, John. In terms of Trump himself, yeah, I mean, he's the worst trends in the culture. I wouldn't want to say he is the United States, because he's not. Most Americans are much better people than him, and most Americans have a whole range of countervailing trends and so on. But yeah, the culmination of these trends that are really a sickness, you can see, and I really think it's played out. You know, I had this moment that for me was this defining moment of the election. It was a couple of months before the election, and I was doing some writing about some amazing people for a different book about people trying to get out the vote, who were trying to get out the vote in Cleveland, in West Cleveland, which is a really depressed part of West Cleveland. One of those streets where like a third of the houses have been abandoned, a third have been demolished, and a third still have people living in them. And we knocked on one door, and there was a woman who I would have guessed from looking at her was 60. I discovered from the conversation she was the same age as me. I was 37 at the time. She was very intelligent. She was quite articulate, extremely angry. And she made this verbal slip that's really stayed with me. She was talking about what the area used to be like for her parents and grandparents. And she meant to say when I was young. What she actually said is when I was alive. And it really knocked me back, because I thought, that's how she feels, right? And she's not wrong to feel that way. And I can well understand why people in that position say, you know what, I'm going to vote for the guy who says burn the whole thing down, right? And for us to just say that woman is just racist, I didn't see any evidence she was racist, or to say that woman is stupid, she was certainly not stupid, I think is really missing the point. And it will mean that we, you know, our side keeps losing if we carry on talking about people like that, right? If we don't understand in a compassionate and empathetic way why people are so distressed they've done this. Now, don't get me wrong. As I think is pretty obvious, I think I begged that woman not to make the choice that she made, right? I think it was a catastrophic error of judgment. But and I think her life will now be worse. But I can understand why, and it's not stupidity and it's not racism. I'm not saying there's no racism in support for Trump. Of course there is. But we've got to have more complex, just like we've got to have more complex conversations about depression. If we live in a society that doesn't meet people's psychological needs, that's going to manifest in all sorts of disturbing ways. One of them will be a depression crisis. One of them will be the opioid crisis. One of them will be, you know, rising support for political candidates who, you know, offer more extreme solutions, in inverted commas. And one of them will be an obesity crisis, because people will just drug themselves with food to get through the day, right? There'll be a whole range of things going on. Now, I'm not suggesting that's the only cause of any of the things we've talked about. It's not. But if we don't understand this wider perspective that I try to write about in Lost Connections and that many other people have warned us about, I just think the crisis is only going to get worse. And it doesn't have to, right? There are solutions to these problems. There are ways we can reconnect and have better lives that are not magic, and they're not, you know, they're not so extreme, and they're not so hard to get, and they fit with the needs of everyone, whether they're the most diehard Trump voter or the most diehard Bernie voter or the most diehard Hillary voter. You know, which is one of the reasons why actually I was really moved that Hillary Clinton has been so nice about my book. And interestingly, it's been a really fascinating experience because Tucker Carlson, the leading host on Fox News, has been really nice about my book. And Naomi Klein, who's the kind of leading left-wing thinker of our time, has been really nice about my book. And to me, that's been so fascinating to see people from radically different parts of the political spectrum. It's hard to imagine people more different than Tucker Carlson, Hillary Clinton, and Naomi Klein, right?
I'll bet if Donald Trump read your book, he'd like it too. I hear with you about the budget of Trump, but there are a lot of positive reasons that people voted for Trump that are related to your book. And that is that we've been doing bad things, and there needs to be some accountability. And so people voted for Trump to get us in many respects to give a criticism of, well, frankly, a pharmaceutical industry that, you know, is pushing pills, is basically writing the DSM-5, these kinds of things, this medical industrial complex. These kinds of things were long before Trump. And so some of these issues, Trump just kind of scared everything out of the bushes. But anyway, I want to tell you, you can respond to that politically, but I also want to say another thing, and I want to ask you about this, is that we think that depression is the problem, and that this is in the United States, Western UK, Western medicine, that needs to be fixed, and the magical fix right now, and it as you mentioned, it has some benefits, is these SSRIs. But the question is it that the depressed people really sick, or are they talking about the symptoms of larger problems? Are they not, in a sense, the depression that we experience really a prophecy, a truth serum about our dysfunctional value system?
I think that's a really important question. There's an Indian philosopher called Krishnamurti. He said, it's no sign of good health to be well adjusted to a sick society.
Yes.
And I thought about that a lot when I was writing the book. There's a really disturbing illustration of that. In the 1970s, this thing was discovered about depression that was so inconvenient that it was literally got rid of. So the American Psychiatric Association, the APA, decided for the first time they were going to drop guidelines for how you should diagnose depression if you're a doctor. So they drop a list of 10 symptoms, which are pretty obvious things like, you know, crying all the time, feeling worthless. You could guess what they would be. And they sent them out to doctors all over the US, and they said, if you're going to diagnose depression, if any patient has more than 5 of these 10 symptoms for more than 2 weeks, you should diagnose them as depressed. So doctors start using this, but within a few months, they started to come back and say, look, we've got a bit of a problem here. If we use these guidelines, we have to diagnose every grieving person as mentally ill, because these are basically the symptoms of grief, right? And the APA got together and they're like, well, that's not what we intended, obviously. So they invented something that was called the grief loophole, where they basically said, use this checklist to diagnose depression unless the person has lost someone they love in the past year, in which case it doesn't count and you should, you know, don't diagnose them as mentally ill, right? So psychiatrists started using that, but that begged a much bigger question, right? Well, psychiatrists started saying, well, hang on a minute. We're meant to tell people that depression is just a brain disease that you just identify on a checklist, except there's one circumstance in life and only one where this is a completely understandable response and you're not mad, right? Well, hang on a minute. Why is that the only situation where it's legitimate to respond this way? Why not if you've lost your job? Why not if you've lost your home? Why not if you're stuck in a job you hate for the next 40 years, right? Why is this the only situation? But that, as Dr. Joanne Cacciatore, who's a wonderful woman who's the leading expert on this debate about the grief exception, said to me, that would require a whole system overhaul, right? That would require us to think about context when we diagnose people. Our whole system is not geared to do that, right? So the APA just got rid of the grief exception. It doesn't exist anymore. It's gone. So now, if your baby dies at, 9 a.m., if your doctor comes and interviews you and says, well, have you been feeling down for the last few weeks, which a lot of pregnant people are, they can diagnose you half an hour later as mentally ill for crying all the time, feeling distressed, feeling worthless, and in fact, 9% of grieving parents are in fact diagnosed and drugged in the first 48 hours now. You can see how that misunderstands, as Dr. Cacciatore put it to me, grief is not a sickness, right? We grieve because we've loved someone. It is a human response to distress, right? And in a similar way, I don't think it's a coincidence that depression and grief have the same symptoms. I think part of what depression is grief for your own life not going the way it should. Depression is grief for your own needs not being met. And that requires us to think about it very differently. And obviously, when someone we love dies, all we can do is hold the survivors and honor them and remember the person who died. But if it's grief for your own life, well, then there's a lot of things we can do to help you get your deeper needs met. Yeah. And I think that helps us to understand it, just how deeply we misunderstand human suffering in this culture, or how deeply this over-medicalized model, which is not to say there's no value in some of the things they do. Of course, there is. There are great psychiatrists who do a great job, and they are all well-meaning people, pretty much. But we have to have this deeper conversation. We can't carry on talking in this simplistic, almost childlike way about what our distress is.
Yeah, exactly right. Johann Hari is my guest. Lost Connections is his book, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. So here's my last question. People are listening to the show and they're thinking, well, I've been taking these SSRIs for, 5 years. Or in your case, you took them for quite some time, 13 years or something like that. So now they're hearing your show and not that you didn't write a self-help book, but they're doing this. What would you might hope, not to give anybody advice because you're not, but what would you might hope people who are feeling depressed, going through the SSRI thing, doing all of that, what would you hope people might get from reading your book?
Well, I think there's several things. The first thing is you're not crazy. If you're depressed, if you're anxious, if you're in pain, don't let anyone tell you that's just some irrational spasm due to some chemical imbalance in your brain. It's not true. Your pain makes sense. It has meaning. And together, collectively, we can find that meaning and we can deal with those deeper underlying causes. That doesn't mean that you have to deal with them on your own. Indeed, I would say very few people can deal with them on their own. We know this about, car accidents, right? We don't say the job of solving car accidents lies only with people who've already just been mangled in a car wreck, right? We have the whole society responds to the risk of car accidents. So we have driving tests, we have airbags, we have seatbelts, we arrest people who have DUIs, we have speed limits, right? We have a whole range of things. If we didn't do those things, if we just said to drivers, drive carefully, and just said to pedestrians, cross the street carefully, we would have much higher deaths on the roads than we do now. So part of what I argue in my book, Lost Connections, is in a way, the question you've just asked, so I don't criticize you for making it in any way, because this is what a lot of people, in a sense, puts the onus on the wrong people, right?
Yeah.
Actually, I don't think the job of solving depression should lie just with people who are already depressed and anxious, right? I think it should lie with the whole, precisely because the causes lie in the whole society. The solutions have to come from the whole society. Now, what I would say is, the act of coming together and fighting for something better in itself has a really powerful antidepressant effect, right? The struggle is the solution. But I also talk in Lost Connections about 7 things that we can fight for that will have a really, that the evidence suggests will have a really powerful antidepressant effect. But I think in a sense, it's not that it's the wrong question to ask. It's an important question to ask, but to me, it's not the most important question to ask. And certainly framing it as about antidepressants is not, my advice to people who take chemical antidepressants is, if for you, the 1.8 points people gain on the Hamilton scale, or a bit more for some people, because that's an average, outweigh the side effects, then you should carry on taking them. If they don't, then I would recommend, in consultation with your doctor, over a very long period of time, considering reducing and being monitored very carefully. Do not stop overnight. That's a disaster, because 20% of people have really severe physical withdrawal, which is a nightmarish experience. You really don't want to go through that. So if you're going to cut back, do so very slowly in consultation with your doctor. But in a way, we need a bigger solution than you know, and there are bigger solutions waiting for us. Most people know this is a deeper crisis than we are, you know, than we've been told by our doctors. Most people can sense that intuitively.
Johann Hari, his book is Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. Johann, thank you for all your work on this, for sharing your personal story and for spending time with me today.
I'm really grateful for how deeply you engage with the book. I should also just say, can my publishers tell me off if I don't? Anyone who wants any more information about the book, they can find out what Hillary Clinton, Russell Brand, Arianna Huffington, BJ Novak, loads of people, Tucker Carlson said about it. You can go to www.thelostconnections.com. They can hear audio of interviews with all the people we talked about, all the experts. They can take a quiz to see how much they know about the real causes of depression and anxiety, and they can find out where to get the book and the audiobook as well. Great. Thanks so much.
Progressive Spirit is heard every week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed every week through the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the public radio exchange. My media empire has now invaded New Hampshire. Progressive Spirit will live free or die at 3A Oldies 91.9 in Epsom, New Hampshire. Thanks also to the following stations for carrying Progressive Spirit every week: WETS, Johnson City, Tennessee; WEHC, Emory, Virginia; WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina; Kutztown University Radio, Kutztown, Pennsylvania; KCEI, Taos, New Mexico; KACR, Alameda, California; WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin; KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon; KYAQ, Newport, Oregon; KBOG, Bandon, Oregon; and KZ88, Kabul, Missouri. You can download Progressive Spirit for free on your favorite podcast app. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schack. Be well.